Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, faithfully at his post in the early hours of the 1st of October, 2013. This would be nav briefing number 89, Correction Comes True. Speaking of correction, I'd like to start by correcting a couple of small errors I made in recent briefings. When I was talking about Carlos Castaneda, I referred to the year that he published his first book, The Teachings of Don Juan, and it was published by the campus press of UC Berkeley. Of course, I said UCLA, Berkeley. That doesn't make any sense. It's UC Berkeley, which is across the bridge from San Francisco, where I was living at the time with Jan Kerouac. Also, in regard to Castaneda's genotype, as it's called in Starbase, I believe I used the term biological evidence, when actually, of course, I meant biographical evidence. So Castaneda had the sun in the constellation of the Archer, corresponding to Kurukula in the system of the Mahavidyas and Dakinis. And the presence of the sun in his birth data in that location provides a biographical evidence that the constellation of the Archer may be associated with sorcery, whether it be the Neo-Toltec version or variety of Castaneda, or the sorcery of love and intention, which is a nickname for planetary tantra. Also, I spoke of a website dedicated to Castaneda's work. There are, of course, dozens and dozens of such websites. I cited one, which I believe was a forum-type website, Sustained Reaction. In fact, the main site dedicated to Castaneda, which has been active constantly and consistently for many years, is called Sustained Action, not Sustained Reaction. And that's about it. There have been a few recording glitches, a strange static that comes up. I'm recording on a new Mac with a different microphone. Now I'm back to the old microphone. We'll see how it goes with this briefing. It's a cool night here in Spain. It's been raining for the last couple of days. As you know, according to the Gaian calendar of Merita, the fall equinox, which generally falls around the 21st of September, which is conventionally considered to be the first day of fall, is regarded as the midpoint of the fall season. So fall began around August 2nd. We reached the midpoint of fall last week, and we're heading rapidly toward the first day of winter, which is November 1st in the Gaian calendar, following the Celtic calendar, which emphasizes the cross-quarter days and the four festivals of the year in Celtic paganism. The winter rains have come early this year, which is great for the earth, great for the land here. It's been cool and moist for days due to a storm front rolling in from the Atlantic. We are currently, as I make this recording, in day 26 of the Shodashi shift of 2013. There are a couple of comments I could make about the timing of this shift and the character of instruction that I've received. I mentioned in previous briefing, it was either in 88 or the addendum to 88, that I've come to realize in this shift, and uniquely in the current shift of Shodashi, that her instruction concerns the true psychology of the Anthropos and the structure and dynamics of the endopsyche, or human subconscious. I personally have had a very long history with the problem of modern psychology. I can remember very well the day when I couldn't have been more than 16, maybe a few months before my 17th birthday, wandering around the city of New York checking out the bookstores. And I found The Interpretations of Dreams by Freud and felt obligated to read it. At that time, I hadn't read any modern psychology except for C.G. Jung, Modern Man in Search of a Soul. But I knew who the main players were, of course, Freud and Jung. And I felt obligated to learn something about them because I wanted to know something about the psyche, about the human mind and soul, and the psychological processes that drive the human animal. I had an intense curiosity for that from an early age. Well, back in those days, I used to go down to New York as a teenager to get away from Maine and look for some culture and stimulation. I mean, I had exquisite natural beauty in Friendship, Maine, and I loved the harbor and the setting, and wandered among the woods and ledges of that fabled land, which nurtured me and inspired me. But I also had a craving for the big city and for culture. So I would spend a couple of months in Brooklyn, living with my Italian relatives, ranging around the Lower East Side and Greenwich Village during the height of the hippie movement, I guess you could say, the birth of the hippie movement, the early days of Bob Dylan. And when the time came to return to Maine, to return for September, to return to school, or go to the university, as I did for a brief period, I would take the Greyhound bus from central Manhattan to Waldoboro, Maine. And I can remember how much I loved the feeling of coziness and intimacy to be seated on the bus somewhere, with the lamp shining down from above, seated and cocooned in a Greyhound bus on what I think must have been a 10 or 12 hour ride. And in that way, I would return from New York to Maine. And I distinctly remember reading The Interpretation of Dreams by Sigmund Freud while I was snuggled into a seat in the Greyhound bus. I was on the right side of the bus as it was driving up the Maine coast on Route 1. And on this one particular occasion, when I returned in early September, the route of the bus along Route 1 took me through the early hours of the morning. And so I could see the moon shining off to my right over the estuaries of the state of Maine, of which there are many. And the moonlight was gleaming on the estuaries as the bus steamed up Route 1. And there I was, tucked into The Interpretation of Dreams by Freud, and I have to say, I found it difficult and rather irritating, and it didn't make much sense to me. But you know how it is when you have a young and hungry mind and you think you need to learn something and you haven't been told that maybe that the sources you're investigating are not really worth your attention. You think that Freud must have had something to say that was important and viable because so many people attributed importance to his works. So you don't know when you're young that those attributions can be wrong. So I struggled to get the point of the interpretation of dreams, and there really is no point. It doesn't really hang together in any way. It's extremely contrived and unconvincing. But I remember one thing, clearly, that came into my mind and even impacted my body with a bit of a shock as I sat there in the seat of the Greyhound bus in the middle of the night. I remember reading in the introduction to The Interpretation of Dreams that the author of the introduction, who was probably the translator, said that Freud considered dreams to be mythological. And that for me was a really great key. In fact, that was probably the only clue that I took away from The Interpretation of Dreams, because Freud never really had a method. You know, Freud was a faker. He was a pretender and a fraud. There was really no Freudian method. Freudian method is a joke. When he began his career, he pretended that he had a method. It was called the talking cure. It wasn't any method at all. I mean, Freud just made it up as he went along. Now, you know, take a few steps back there, Mimedes. I don't have any objection to doing that, obviously. But you have to make it up well, and you have to make it up soundly and beautifully and coherently, and he didn't. So the whole Freudian spiel didn't really register with me, but that statement that he considered the dreams and the content of dreams to be mythological really shook my boat. And also, you know, there's an epigraph to The Interpretation of Dreams. That is to say, a quotation he puts at the front of the book. It's in Latin, and it's taken from, I think it's taken from either Ovid's Metamorphosis or the Aeneid. I can't really remember the Aeneid or Virgil, but it's a line that also shook my boat, and it goes like this. If I cannot persuade the higher powers, then I will move the infernal regions. Now that statement, that citation from an ancient Latin text adopted by Freud as the epigraph for The Interpretation of Dreams stated his credo. It stated his stance, and that citation belongs to the self-heroic portrait that Freud constructed of himself through his entire career. He heroicized himself as a rebel and an outsider and someone who was a taboo breaker and someone who was a renegade. And so he cites the line, if I cannot persuade the higher powers, then I will move the infernal regions. And that line really struck with me, and I would say that I also, at that moment, sitting on that bus, the tender age of 17, adopted that line as my motto or credo without having a full or profound understanding of what it meant or what it could mean or what it was destined to mean for me in the course of my life. But you who are listening to me now and who understand what I mean when I talk about those 16 infernal bitches of the Shakti cluster will realize how I lived out that line and how that line applies today to all of us in a way. If there is to be a genuine psychology of the human endopsyche, the human subconscious, it would rely on a number of key truths, key realizations. And one of those, foremost, would be the recognition of the infernal Dakini powers of the anima mundi, of the intelligent soul of the earth itself. Well, in the Shakti cluster of planetary tantra, you have a complete profile, and not just a profile, but an instrument of access to those powers in the infernal regions. You know, I've said in my talks on the apocalypse that the word infernal and the word internal mean the same thing. So infernal in planetary tantra does not mean damned or damning or something horrible and dangerous and torturous and demonic to be avoided or condemned. Infernal refers to what happens in the depths of the earth, and that is to say, in the depths of the soul of the planetary animal mother herself. So to make a long story short, I've had a long history with the problem of modern psychology. And I can say now with great confidence that it failed miserably on almost every count due to the flaws in the initial conditions. Flaws in the initial conditions of Freudian dogma, and equally so, flaws in the initial conditions of Jungian analytic psychology. It wasn't until my mid-20s, I think, that I discovered Wilhelm Reich, and what a relief that was. I can tell you there are very few flaws in the initial conditions of the system of biopsychology of Wilhelm Reich. What I'm finding over the last week, and especially through the moment of the hinge, is that Shodashi instructs in this genre. She is the teacher of the future psychology, as I already suggested in NB88. And in that respect, I propose that you might rename her with somewhat of a formal Greek title, Euphanes, meaning the one who reveals salubrity, health, and sanity. Now, this word, Euphanes, is actually closely related to a word invented by another leading psychologist who came in the second generation after Freud, Jung, Reich, Ferenczi, Adler, and those boys. And that would be someone called Abraham Maslow, M-A-S-L-O-W. Maslow is widely regarded as the father of one of the leading pioneers of humanistic psychology. And I have widely cited Maslow a number of times in my work. I cite him in Quest for the Zodiac as a visionary who looks forward to the true transpersonal psychology of the Anthropos. Look to Maslow for that. Most people would look to Jung for that. Unfortunately, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but you won't find it in Jung. You know, I have a long entangled romance with Jung. I drew extensively upon his writings on alchemy because as a young man working hard labor jobs in my 20s and 30s, I couldn't afford to purchase any original alchemical manuscripts, obviously, even if they were for sale, nor could I afford to go to the rare collections where they were held. So I got my information on alchemy secondhand through the writings of C.G. Jung, Psychology and Alchemy, Alchemical Studies, and the massive work Mysterium Conjunctionis. Those three books I probably read at least 10 times each. I drew very deeply on the alchemical material in Jung. And also I was deeply influenced by his other concepts, such as the animus anima concept, the archetypes of the collective unconscious, and so forth. But I was never really satisfied with Jung. And my whole discontent with that individual, who was a visionary Gnostic in his own right, culminated when I discovered the story of his mistress, Sabina Spielrein, who came to him at the age of 18 when Jung was 28, and he was the rising star at the Bregozli Clinic outside Zurich. So I told that whole story in my screenplay, Sabina. And understanding who Sabina was is a key to understanding both the problem and the solution of modern psychology. She was, as one writer put it, Aldo Caratenuto, who analyzed her letters and manuscripts that were found many years after she died, said that she was positioned in a secret symmetry. There was a ménage à trois and triangle between Sabina Spielrein, Jung, and Freud. She knew them both. In many ways, Sabina's psychology, her contributions to psychology, surpassed them both, and both Jung and Freud stole from Sabina without crediting her. So this is a great untold story of the foundations of modern psychology. I consider it to be the single most revealing story that one would have to know to proceed with the correction of psychology toward the instruction of Euphanes, toward the true psychology of the endopsyche, of the antipos. And the moment for that has happened. It's an event in correction. It's an event that unfolds in September of 2013 in correction. The doorway opens, the pathway opens now to this new psychology. And the development of it will continue after the 3 years of the GNE. What I want to say right now, just referring back to Maslow, is that he introduced a term which was eupsychian, spelled E-U-P-S-Y-C-H-I-A-N. So that's an adjective, obviously, formed from the combination of the root EU, which means salubrity or health or sanity, and psyche. So it means of the health and sanity of the psyche. And Maslow actually founded a new approach to psychology, which he called at times eupsychian management, which referred to the highest and best sane and healthy developments of the human beings, of the human animal. What Maslow has noted, Maslow lived, by the way, from 1908 until 1970, and he's best known as the American psychologist who created the hierarchy of needs, which I have modified, by the way. You'll find that in some of the astrological material attached to Starbase. And he's also known for his being part of the human potential movement and for being a leader and trailblazer in the path of what is called self-actualization. So Maslow's observation about Freud and Jung that launched him on his career is by now famously known. Maslow simply observed that both Freud and Jung based their paradigms of psychic dynamics and their syntax for modern psychology upon sick and disturbed people. Hysterics, psychotics, schizophrenics, call them what you will. So both Freud and Jung began by consulting with such people, Freud in private practice in Vienna, Jung at the Bregozli Clinic in Zurich. They converged in the year 1904 and 1905, and they converged over the woman, Sabina Spielrein, by the way. She was the occasion for the beginning of the famous Freud-Jung correspondence. But there they were working in these different areas in Austria and Switzerland. And they were studying, the subjects of their studies were sick and demented, deranged, unhappy, broken, miserable, suffering people. And Maslow asked the question, well, why would you establish and formulate the foundational principles of human psychology based on the worst instances of the species, the broken down and demented examples of humanity? And so Maslow is quoted as saying, Maslow, it is as if Freud supplied us the sick half of psychology, and we must now fill it out with the healthy half. And so what Maslow proposed is to study mentally healthy human individuals instead of people with serious psychological problems. I mean, how obvious can you be? And he advised that psychology ought to be formulated on a study of the behavior of self-actualizing people who are sane, who are happy, who are creatively and sexually fulfilled, and who in some cases enjoy what he called peak experiences. That is, high points in life when the individual reaches some kind of harmony with himself and the world around him or herself through creativity and inspiration and some form of spiritual outlook, if you will. So this is how Abraham Maslow thought that psychology could be constructed, along the lines of a Eusykian approach, concentrating on what is sane and salubrious in the psyche. Well, of course, the word Eusykian is not so far from the word Euphanes, is it? Shodashi, in her role as instructor of the future psychology of the Anthropos, could be called Eupsyche. And I find that her instruction has come through this time in a way that I did not previously grasp. You know, how many instances of the Shodashi shift in the fall of each year have I lived since 2008 when I began to observe these cycles within the framework of planetary tantra? Well, you know, 5 or 6. And not until this one, when we are 2/3 of the way or more through the initialization of correction, not until now, at that moment, did I begin to get what her instruction is. I cannot say that I had really a clear inkling or intuition of her instruction until now. Of course, I associated her with beauty and elegance. Her name is Sundari, the beautiful one. Of course, I associated these themes of beauty and elegance with a tantric or erotic approach to life. So I had more or less a vague or general feeling about Shodashi, which you as well may have shared, those of you who follow the shifts of the Dakinis and Mahavidyas. And in this general sense, I felt that she represents that mood of the planetary animal mother that enhances beauty and, of course, by extension, enhances well-being, because beauty and well-being go together. Sane and healthy people are beautiful, but not all people considered to be beautiful are sane and healthy. The reason for that, obviously, is because the standards of beauty in our modern world are very corrupt and distorted and fraudulent. But I think you can allow, as a general principle, that health, which is a great treasure of the human animal, and beauty, that is to say physical and moral beauty, the true beauty of a person, go together. And so these standards or these values resonate now for me in a new way. And what I'm saying is, I find the instruction of Euphanes coming through big time and in a very big way. I pointed out one realization that I had that I would put in the category of her instruction. I pointed out, and to me this is an absolutely amazing and world-changing insight, if I may be so bold as to say so. I pointed out that when the so-called predators perpetrate an act of evil on this planet, such as the assassination of JFK or 9/11, they do so following a method which is now recognized to be a traumatic imprinting. So they traumatize the public with a horrific event like the attacks of 9/11, which is totally staged and orchestrated. And while the herd of human animals, the collective, is in a state of shock, they imprint it with their agenda. In that case, their agenda was the false narrative of the official story of 9/11 and the implications drawn from that narrative, which led to Homeland Security, which led to the destruction of the Constitution, which led to the sacrifice of human rights for a phony sense of security, which led to the implementation and expansion of neocon imperialism in the Middle East and so forth and so forth and so on. So all that, all those events belong to the agenda that was imprinted upon into the collective mind, into the endopsyche, if you will, through the traumatic event. However, what I come to realize now is that when a human individual animal is traumatized, and when the entire herd of human society is traumatized, something else happens that the predators do not count on, nor can they control. With the massive traumatization of 9/11, which was a psyop perpetrated upon the entire human population of this planet, through that traumatic event, the endopsyche of the Anthropos was catalyzed to action. It was shocked into action. In the same way that the immune system of the human body is shocked into action when a toxin enters the body, or a virus, or an alien entity of some kind. And so what the predators do not reckon on when they shock the world and traumatize the collective psyche with such events is that the endopsyche has a healthy response to that shock. Certainly, the shock provides the predators with the advantage to enforce their agenda. And it works, as you can clearly see. But that is not the only thing that happens. At the same time, there is another development, a reverberation from within the endopsyche itself, you could say. Specifically now, I've come to understand at this moment in correction, and I think this has to do with correction coming true, I've come to understand that that act of traumatization has a positive effect in the endopsyche, in that it stimulates the pattern detecting capacity of the human subconscious. And so, as I explained, while Neil Cramer, who is typical of many self-appointed teachers today, who purports to explain current events, when he attributes the correspondences of symbolic and occult symbols and references to dates and references to ancient gods and goddesses. And that whole ensemble of associations, when he attributes that to a deliberate orchestration of the predators, he is entirely wrong. That perception of patterns extending to archetypal, symbolic, and occult levels of association comes out of the self-generated pattern-detecting power of the endopsyche. It is wrongly attributed to the perpetrators. It needs to be attributed to the subconscious of the human psyche. So if you go back and look at the massive education and awakening that has occurred since 9/11, you have the evidence of what I'm saying. I believe you will see the direct evidence, and this evidence now becomes brazenly and blatantly clear as the initial conditions of correction become more clear and more vividly and dynamically evident. What do you see in the wake of the traumatic event of 9/11? An enormous explosion of conspiracy theories. Well, we know that these conspiracy theories are actually, for the most part, although some of them are wacky and deranged, they are, for the most part, accurate and viable constructions of the true nature of the event. And the constructions that we call conspiracy theories arise because human animals as individuals are applying the pattern detecting capacity of the endopsyche. And so they see patterns. Now, it is said as a kind of a joke and in a dismissive way that paranoia is seeing patterns where they don't exist. But that's a dismissive comment that fails to acknowledge the true power and function of the pattern detecting capacity of the human psyche. I can assure you, well, I don't have to assure you because many of you have made these studies yourself over the last 12 years, that the patterns detected by so-called conspiracy theorists around the events of 9/11 are accurate and true to facts. And so the patterns detected and exposed by conspiracy theorists, for instance, the patterns of the business transactions that occurred in the global financial markets just preceding the event of 9/11. Those patterns are not a paranoid fantasy. They are an accurate result of the working of the pattern detecting capacity of the endopsyche, which is activated by trauma. And we reach the point now, the world reaches the point, I should say, and many, many people in the world, certainly millions, have reached the point after 12 years since 9/11 when that pattern detecting capacity has created a new awareness, a new vigilance. And so today, this month, in Syria, when the psychopathic perpetrators in American politics who are running proxy operations for the Zionists attempted to instigate an attack against Syria, they found themselves repelled. They found themselves shot down and checkmated before they could pull it off. Why? Because so many people including mainstream people and including other major players in the geopolitical theater, such as Putin, see the pattern. They see the pattern of the perpetrators. And that is due to this natural ability in the human endopsyche. So I had that realization. Then I had another realization that I would also categorize as a psychological breakthrough deriving in some way from the instruction of Shudashi. Sitting in the kitchen in Embercane House, chatting with Kundry in one of our most enjoyable and instructive conversations, of which we have many. Conversational art is a tantric art, you know. And I said to her, you know, I think I realized something that I never understood before about a question that really tormented me. And I went on to set it up in this way. I said, you know, there's an initial concept or an assumption or proposition in the initial conditions of modern psychology that really bothers me. And I always knew this concept was wrong, or I've known for a long time it was wrong, but didn't know why. What is this concept? Well, it lays down roughly like this. It goes back to Freud. There's an assumption that when there was abuse in the childhood of a human animal, sexual abuse or whatever, or some kind of trauma, that there is a tendency in the psyche to repress the memory of that trauma, to repress the memory of pain. And yet the repressed pain becomes in itself a driving force. And it operates insidiously in the subconscious. And then there comes a moment in the therapeutic process, if you will, when the subject needs to recover that pain by remembering the incident in which it was inflicted. And it is widely considered that remembering the incident, which Freud called the primal incident, and reliving the pain of that incident is a therapeutic event. And in fact, this dynamic I'm describing constitutes the basis of a model of therapy, doesn't it? This is a model of therapy, which is conducted in various ways, regression therapy, Freudian analysis, whatever. And I said to Kundry, you know, what always really bothered me about this notion of therapy is that it attributes a power to pain that for some reason we don't attribute to pleasure. And that never made sense to me. And so I thought, why should it be that the pain of a traumatic experience undergone by a person in their childhood, man or woman, boy or girl, why would it be that that painful moment, that painful incident, would register in the body and be retained subconsciously in an extremely powerful and influential manner, and moments of great pleasure are not so retained? And that really bothered me. It's a question I asked why. For a long time, I asked why. And just last week, right on the hinge, as we were having this conversation, bingo, I saw why. I saw why that appears to be the case. It is not, in fact, actually the case. The reason why, again, goes back to the initial conditions of the formation of the therapeutic model of modern psychology. The subjects upon which Freud and Jung based their models were abnormal. They were damaged, wounded people who carried pain. Now, those particular subjects, by contrast to the people that Maslow advised ought to be the subjects, those particular subjects were unhappy people. And due to the experiences that they had undergone, their pleasure function, or pleasure principle as Freud called it, pleasure drive, was thwarted. Now take the instance of someone whose pleasure drive was not thwarted. Someone whose pleasure drive was not thwarted, an individual human animal who maintained their pleasure drive through its discovery in childhood and then through adolescence and later in life, could also have been subjected to abuse and traumatic experiences of the kind typically seen in Freud and Jung's clients or patients. But the individual who retained their pleasure drive at a normal level, a normal and healthy level, at a Eusykian level, would have in their body an energetic component to balance out the component of the retained pain of the trauma. And so consequently, such an individual would not need to relive the trauma to overcome it, because it would be compensated naturally over time by living out the pleasure drive. But since Freud and Jung never engaged with people who were living out the pleasure drive, the hedonic drive of the human animal, in a healthy way and in an optimal way, leading towards self-actualization, to use Maslow's term, since they never engaged with people like that, then they necessarily were dealing with a very bad sampling of traumatized people. They were dealing with that sampling of traumatized people whose pleasure drive was not strong enough to compensate for the pain imprinted upon them by their abuse. And so they drew a whole range of completely wrong conclusions by the bad sampling and the partial sampling they used as the basis for clinical basis, right, for their psychological models. Now, that mistake was a terrible, terrible mistake, which still inflicts and distorts the perception of the human psyche today. How much more emphasis do you still see today on the carryover of imprinted pain and imprinted trauma and the attempt to deal with that by a regression to it and a reliving of it, which in my mind is completely unnecessary. In a healthy person whose pleasure drive is strong enough to naturally compensate for the constituent pain. Do you see my point? But how much emphasis do you see today on pain management? And where has the pain management treatment gone? Directly into psychotropic prescription drugs. And this development has now reached epidemic levels of mental disease and insanity due to the obliged application of psychiatric drugs is destroying and has destroyed a great part of the population on this planet. And all of that goes back to the errors in the initial conditions of modern psychology. And all of that now in correction and under the specific guidance and oversight of Euphanes falls apart. And as it falls apart, because this psychology can no longer be sustained, this model leads only to more illness. Because of that, as James Hillman famously observed some time ago, at the end of the 20th century, we've had 100 years of psychoanalysis and we're crazier than ever. Why? It's an observation of James Hillman, a sort of neo-Jungian psychologist. This insanity is a result of a fallacious and distorted model of the endopsyche. And as the insanity reaches the peak level, the model disintegrates and the mental space, if you will, the mental space opens for a new understanding of psychology. And I would not be surprised if in the remaining months of the GNE and subsequent months after the 3 years, I would not be surprised if there are dramatic breakthroughs and new models and directions in psychology that come to light, that just spring up out of the ground like mushrooms as a result of the breakthrough that is now occurring. So it's quite wonderful for me to be caught up in the current of this Eupsychian shift. And I am really thrilled by the understanding that the true psychology of the Anthropos can be recognized by the propositions in which it's stated. And those propositions will be simple, they will be self-evident, and they will be beautiful and elegant. Because, in fact, ultimately speaking, the operations of the endopsyche, of the Anthropos, are as beautiful and elegant as any of the operations of external nature. And why shouldn't they be? Why shouldn't they be? If this experiment were on track, if this experiment were operating as she dreamed it to its success in the Pleroma, and as she now brings it around to its success, as she does that, the beauty of the operations of the human psyche begins to resemble more the beauty of the operations of nature in the plant and animal kingdoms. So all of that are just some of my reflections on where we stand in correction right now and correction coming true. And so what else can I say about how is correction coming true? Well, remember that I designated the event of the Venus-Saturn conjunction in the middle of September as the return of the sacred masculine. Are there any indications in the collective psychodrama of humanity, in the geopolitical game, and in the transactions of society at large, are there any indications of the return of the sacred masculine in this particular month, September 2013? Well, yes, I can certainly see indications. And among them, I would put at the top of the list the contacts coming into me from crew members and from new people, men out there, who are responding to this call and who are placing themselves in the ranks of those men who would dare to say and care to say, yes, I carry the force of the sacred masculine. Now, you don't have to hold your breath for much longer, because the title of NB number 90 is The Return of the Sacred Masculine. And in that briefing, I will reveal the seven-letter word that I discovered, which proved to be the key to the sacred masculine and to the missing element of male heroism in this world. But for right now, I'd like to propose that we can look for evidence of the sacred masculine in two ways. We can look for it to reveal itself in two different ways. It can reveal itself first merely in an act, that is the kind of act that a man would perform were he basing himself in the sacred masculine. So he can look for certain telltale actions. That does not necessarily mean that the man who performed that action is himself an exemplar of the sacred masculine. That's the second kind of expression. The second kind would be a more complete, mature, and full-blown expression of the sacred masculine in the personality and moral bearing of a male human animal. But short of that, and that's coming really fast, but short of that, the first signs might be rather indicated, as I said, simply by an action that exemplifies what a man would do coming from the sense of the sacred masculine. Now, you know that the head of Russia, Vladimir Putin, is just another gangster in the psychodrama of global politics. I am certainly not going to heroicize him, but I will say that in September of 2013, almost exactly timed to the date of the Venus-Saturn conjunction, he made a major move, which as an act taken in itself is typical of the sacred masculine. That is to say, he made a statement of lethal deterrence. He stepped into the game, which has been compared to a chess game, very accurately, I think, and he made a chess move. And basically he said, as you probably know, well, if anyone attacks Syria, then not only will Syria counterattack, but Russia will bring all the force of its military in that counterattack. And that counterattack will be targeted and directed toward you know who. No one has ever done this recently that I know of in geopolitics. That is to say, stand up to the Zionist Israeli bullies who are continually playing victim while they turn around and victimize others. So Putin called the Israelis on their bluff. He called the bullies and he said, okay, bullies, you do whatever you like, because it's of course the Israelis and the Zionists and AIPAC gang who are driving the American foreign policy. This is another pattern that has been detected since 9/11. And he said, go ahead, make your move. But if you do, we'll blow that stinking country off the face of the earth. And this is a threat typical of the sacred masculine. Something that I've been contemplating a lot over the last couple of years is the phenomenon of threat display in the animal kingdoms. Go look it up. Search the term threat display. Threat display is widely evident in the animal kingdoms outside the human realm. Well, as you know, in Gaian ethics, we look to the animal world as the model for human behavior because humans are animals. We don't consider that animals are animals and we don't behave like animals. We behave like the worst animals. We would be better if we behaved like animals. And one thing that animals do is that they use threat display. Well, likewise, I submit to you that the use of threat display is an action typical of a man who is representing the sacred masculine. Sacred masculine uses threats in order to deal with predators. Threats are the only thing they will understand, but they have to be threats that you can back up, and you can be pretty damn sure that not only the Syrian military, but the Russian military standing behind them can back up the threat that they made to demolish Israel if anybody tries to attack Syria. And this is the checkmate move in global politics, and it is huge, huge. So take note that it happened at the beginning or midpoint, let's say, of the third year of correction, right? And that it happened at that particular moment, closely timed to the omen of Venus and Saturn. The other little detail from news that I would suggest may also indicate that somewhere in the ranks of the power players, some men, regardless of what their character may be, I'm not heroicizing them, some men are taking a stand typical of the sacred masculine. There's a very remarkable news item that came out yesterday that says that the number two officer at the military command in charge of nuclear war fighting forces, a Vice Admiral Giardina, has been suspended and is under investigation by the Naval Criminal Investigation Command. Now, this suspension of an extremely high-ranking admiral in charge of nuclear war weapons actually happened on the 3rd of September, which was the day that a deranged psychopathic senator, Lindsey Graham, a warmongering senator in the U.S. Congress, warned the world that there could be a possible nuclear strike in South Carolina or some other city across America. And that statement of Lindsey Graham coincided with a report coming out of Texas that nuclear warheads had been moved from a base in Texas to an unknown location, which was said to be by the truck driver in South Carolina. Now, this bizarre incident is an example of an outbreak of insanity in the midst of the general insanity of the predators who are acting against this experiment. And it is indeed remarkable that the facts I'm stating strongly suggest that this individual who's in charge of nuclear weapons may have taken a heroic gesture against the agenda to use those weapons for a false flag attack in the United States of America. Now, you know, many people are seeing this as the checkmate move of the predators. Don't know if you know about that. But the best commentators on the internet, such as Pepe Escobar, James Corbett, and Paul Craig Roberts, just to name three, not to mention even Gerald Celente, these individuals are pointing to a pattern. Again, they are speaking for the human endopsyche. They are drawing upon what the endopsyche itself has detected in the patterns of behavior of the predators. And the current warning that's buzzing around the alternative media is that those geopolitical powers, mainly Israel, the Zionists, the Zads, whose plan in the Middle East has been thwarted in one move by Putin, may resort to a false flag nuclear attack somewhere in the United States of America in order to have their justification to resume their program of aggression in the Middle East, because they're going to need an enormous pretext. And that would be a pretty damn convincing pretext to a lot of people. But on the other hand, there are some human animals out there who wouldn't be convinced in the least by such a false flag nuclear attack on American soil. And so this is the point we've reached, my friends. This is the point we've reached. And it is an endgame scenario where the mettle and morality of men who are in the position of power players are going to have to make decisions. Now, it's possible that this Giardini, if that's his name, Giardina, was a renegade admiral like the one played by Stuart Granger in Doctor Strangelove. It's a good time to go back and rewatch Doctor Strangelove, by the way, because we're at reaching a Doctor Strangelove moment. And it's possible that this high-ranking Admiral Guardini in charge of nuclear weapons was part of the setting up of this false flag nuclear attack on the United States of America, which will either happen or not happen in the month of November, sometime between the 6th and the 22nd, I would guess, from the GNE parameters. It's possible that he's part of the problem. It's also possible that he was part of the solution and that he knew about the removal of these warheads illegally and without authorization from Texas to South Carolina. I don't really know. Nobody knows. But the general look of the incident suggests that somebody is taking a stand here and taking a stand against the predators from within their own system of military power is an indication that the sacred masculine is returning. You see, the sacred masculine defines itself in a number of ways, but primarily by the defense of life. And I'll talk more about this in the next briefing. So those men who act in the defense of life, even though they may be corrupt gangsters like Putin, can play a role in the return of the sacred masculine. But of course, we want more than that, don't we? We want real men of heart and beauty. We want real heroes who act heroically. We don't just want gangsters who happen to act heroically in a particular situation. And sure, gangsters can be heroic. Go back and look at Al Pacino films, like Carlito's Way, or Heat with Robert De Niro. There are many examples in cinema of the heroism of gangsters and violent and corrupt people. That is not the fulfillment of the return of the sacred masculine, but it is something that we may expect to happen in the course of that return. Now we're down to 1 hour and 10 minutes of this briefing. I only have another 10 minutes to go. I haven't gotten around to quite a number of things I wanted to present. There are quite a number of events and trends today that reveal that correction is coming true. But obviously I can't present them at length in the remainder of this briefing. There are just two things I'd like to cover in conclusion. The first concerns my treatment of the Castaneda material in some recent briefings. I'd like to make it perfectly clear that I consider the Castaneda material to be, in large measure, a purely anecdotal. There are particular elements in Castaneda which anticipate planetary tantra. I stress that over and over again. Right now, I've started to reread The Fire from Within, which is the 7th book. Now, as I recall, The Fire from Within has very particular and salient elements that look forward to planetary tantra. I'm going to look for those as I reread it, and I'm going to lay those out eventually in a briefing. So I do consider certain thematic elements and certain technical points of Castaneda's sorcery to still be relevant to us today. They are worth looking at, they are worth considering. Also, I would like to advise those of you who are too young to have followed Castaneda or who did not follow him during those 30 years when he was in vogue, just don't be concerned that you're not missing anything here. You can disregard it. It's not absolutely essential. Don't feel left out because you didn't happen to get on the boat or on the bus when Castaneda was driving it through our lives over those 3 decades. The other point regarding Castaneda that I want to make is, yes, it is remarkable and entertaining that certain people are showing up in the Nahual's life who appear to present the profiles of those people in the sorcerer's party described in the Eagle's Gift. I refer, of course, particularly to the 4 types of women, the northerly woman, the westerly woman, and so forth. Okay, all that is fine. I just want to say, however, that the description of the westerly woman, which I read from the Eagle's Gift, really doesn't fit the westerly woman that I know. It's just an anecdotal fragment out of Castaneda that I found amusing. The energetic profile, the energetic or emotional signature of the westerly woman, as Castaneda gives it, does fit the westerly woman of my acquaintance, namely Kundry. But that's as far as it goes. Likewise, for the energetic signatures, you might call them, the energetic and emotional signatures of the 4 women. They do appear to fit certain women who've come into my life this month and who've been here in the background for a while, and to apply as well to some who are appearing on the horizon. Well, what do I make of that? I don't make a big deal out of it. I mean, I enjoy it. But it's not essential to what is happening in planetary tantra. And particularly, it is only prefatory to a much larger event, if that. It may be prefatory. The appearance of these energies personified in these women may be prefatory to a much larger event. And what is that event? The formation of the Kalika War Party. In the Eagle's Gift and subsequent books, Castaneda devotes a great deal of time to the intricacies of his war party, consisting of 8 and 16 men and women in pairs, dreamers and stalkers, personalities correlated to the four directions, personalities assigned with specific functions, and so forth and so on. Well, those of you who know Castaneda well, I think would agree with my view that his scenario of the warrior party is elaborate and overcomplicated and may reflect in certain ways some kind of indulgence that Castaneda was subject to. And it may also represent a way that he disguised or obscured people in his life. Whatever the case, the gathering of Castaneda's war party is a thing of the past. It came to the world by presentation in a literary genre, the genre of magical realism, which is the genre of Castaneda's writings, comparable to that of other South American authors, such as Gabriel Marquez, Asturias, and others, Isabel Allende. Well, Planetary Tantra is not a literary genre. It is a true genre of interactive magic. It is truly the sorcery of love and intention, grounded in interactivity with the planetary animal mother. And as I said, the difference between Castaneda and Planetary Tantra is that we were always catching up with him in the new book that came out. But in each new book, he described things that had happened in the past, so we were catching up with the past. Today, in Planetary Tantra, and in the GNE, and particularly in the formation of the Kalika War Party, we're not catching up with anything. It's all current. It's happening now. It's happening as I speak. It unfolds with every briefing I release. It's happening simultaneously and concurrently in your lives all over the world. All over the world. In countries from Russia to New Zealand, to Peru, Chile, Canada, the UK, Italy, Spain, you name it. And so this ongoing real-time event is the spectacular display of sorcery that comes from the Aeon Sophia herself. She dreams the organization of the party of Gaian sorcerers. She dreams the connections between us, and she dreams us into connection with each other. The dreaming power of the planetary animal mother pulls together this warrior's party now at this critical, beautiful, and precarious moment in her correction.